Welcome to Pushback, a social justice podcast produced and distributed by Philadelphia Magazine and Word Radio.
What's up, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to Pushback. This is Flood the Drummer.
And Malcolm Burnley.
And this is the season finale. So we want to thank all of our core listeners who've been checking us out since the first episode with the MLK Day. And then finally with this one, we're going to be talking with Rochelle Bilal, who's the president of the Guardian Civic League, and having a conversation that we haven't really had yet, Malcolm, about policing. Throughout the entire season, we've covered a lot of stuff. We've covered immigration. We've covered solidarity. We've covered movement-based activism. We haven't had a conversation about policing today. Well, we haven't had a conversation about policing yet, I should say.
Well, particularly, I guess, about, I think a lot of the conversation we're going to have today is about being black within the police system or within the criminal justice system and kind of the dual role that sometimes you're tugged in where...
Black and blue.
Black and blue, right? Where, you know, as I've heard, obviously anecdotally, because obviously I wouldn't know personally, but often being put in a position where, say, maybe on the outside in the community, you're having to defend or at least explain kind of the police's position on things, and then conversely within the police department maybe often having to take the role of, you know, being an African-American and explaining, say, how the community would feel, or also educating, you know, fellow police officers in that sense. So it's definitely a difficult thing, and I think, you know, we've had some conversations. There's definitely been a lot of think pieces written about, like, or even as firsthand accounts of, you know, being a black police officer right now and what that means and how it's really difficult. I mean, you've been at a lot of protests, right?
Yeah. I mean, I have to imagine that being a black cop today has to be, I imagine that there's a lot of dual consciousness that's happening, and I imagine that there's a lot of, so my godbrother just became a cop 2 years ago. He's working out in the 39th district, and he was a pastor, and he wanted to be a drummer, and we would get him teaching him drum lessons, and then he says he wanted to be a cop. And he says he wanted to be a cop for righteous reasons. And I think a lot of people want to become a cop for righteous reasons. And then, you know, people always say, well, that righteousness won't last long once you get into that system. And so I think that with black cops in particular, the most pushback they're getting seems to be from people who look like them. And it seems that they got into policing to protect people who look like them. And then they're finding out that the people who look like them don't necessarily always appreciate what they're doing. And maybe they want them to join on them. Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's be real, right? I mean, at a lot of protests, right? I mean, it's not only protesters will be directly saying things to black officers, right?
And you said they won't?
They will.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, and directly, you know, speaking to them directly as opposed to just
speaking to... one of the lines, and this is something I look forward to talking with Rochelle about, is, you know, lately the protests about David Jones, but even before that, there would be so much vitriol towards the black cops in particular.
Right.
Right? Because I think the vitriol to the white cops are expected, right? Call them cracker pigs and all that shit. But I think that when you go to the black cops, like, for example, at the most recent protest, Asa Khalif of Black Lives Matter said something to the black cops saying that, you know, you take off your badge, they're still going to call you nigger. And you should be joining with us. And I think that some people that might catch them and it'd be caustic, right? And some people might think it's unnecessary. But then I think, too, when you think about the creation of the Guardian Civic League and why it exists, there is some truth to that, right? That even if you are a black police officer, you're trying to do the right thing, not only are you getting this pushback from the people you're supposed to be serving, your colleagues are giving you pushback.
Absolutely.
Right? And so, I mean, it seems, again, that they're getting it at all ends.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really difficult position to be in. And also, I mean, on top of that, there's been so much effort to recruit, right, more minority police officers. And then, I mean, I think there is an added burden to being a black, say, police officer, probably being a Latino police officer. So it makes the job more difficult. And not only are you entering the system, which traditionally, and Rochelle will speak to, you know, I mean, has been known for, you know, discriminatory hiring practices and things of that effect, but also dealing with that extra burden of, like, you know, you having to be in the community and wear those two hats.
But you know what? I've also talked to people. You know, I have a lot of people in my neighborhood who've been arrested, been jailed, been stopped and frisked, you know, and they will often say that it's the black cops that are the worst to them, right? That are, they seem like they have something to prove, that they're more aggressive with them than the white cops. That if it's a black cop and a white cop that show up on the scene, it's usually the white cop that's trying to calm the black cop down if they're in a black neighborhood. I've seen that sometimes at protests where, you know, so Joe Sullivan used to be the chief inspector. Now he's a deputy police commissioner. But Joe Sullivan was on the protest lines. He was a very much more calm, collected type guy. The guy they have now, Singleton, I think his name is, I mean, he's a really aggressive dude. And I think that that does lend to the narrative that sometimes black cops are more aggressive. And I think white cops are equally aggressive, but I think what we see...
I mean, I feel like it's problematic, though, right? Because, I mean, does that have anything to do with race? I mean, in that situation, necessarily? The fact that you're pointing out, like, say, between Joe Sullivan and then, you know, the gentleman who's now in there. I mean, can we definitely say, is that just their personality that he's more... that he's more aggressive? I feel like we're falling into stereotypes.
If it was an isolated incident, if we were looking at just Joe Sullivan and Chief Singleton, then maybe. But I think when you couple that with the narratives and anecdotal information that I've gathered over the years and how people were treated by black cops versus how they're treated by white cops, I think it's not necessarily a stereotype, because I don't think all black cops are aggressive in black neighborhoods. I wouldn't say that. But I'm telling you what I've been told. I've never experienced
that. I think people notice
it
more. No, right? I think either way, I think it's a valid point that's more noticeable when that does happen. And
well,
I think
it's noticeable
eyebrows.
Because people have the expectation, black people have the expectation that the black cop is going to be their friend.
Right.
Or they're going to be able to, like, they'll say, what's it all, bro? And the black cop will be like, I'm not your bro, right? And I think that's appropriate because he's not your bro. He's an officer.
Right. You wouldn't say that to a black firefighter, probably. Or maybe you would.
Well, no, you would.
But you would, but it would be a different, you wouldn't have the same expectation. But I feel like people don't, you know, don't, maybe that's not true. I was going to say people don't, like, complain about black firefighters, you know, have a different expectation that black firefighters will treat people differently. But black police officers, there often is that expectation.
I think that's something, again, I want to talk with Rochelle about. It's just that expectation. And is that a fair expectation that black people should be expecting leniency or camaraderie with black police officers? Or should we be colorblind? In the sense when we're interacting with them. Should our expectation be colorblind, not us be colorblind? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. So a lot of interesting things to cover. So we're going to bring Rochelle on. As Flood already mentioned, president of the Guardian Civic League was a Philadelphia police officer starting in the mid-'80s and has held like a number of titles. You know, used to run, I don't believe it's around anymore, but I could be wrong, the Cops and Citizens for Justice Group, a longtime executive in the Philly NAACP, and has just been a leading... I'd say voice for reform within the police department for decades in terms of discriminatory hiring and internal disciplinary system, and has called out things like the quote unquote good old boy network, Rochelle once said, in terms of the disciplinary system being biased against African-American officers. So a lot to cover. And also Guardian Civic League recently endorsed Larry Krasner, I should say, which was obviously a very different stance than the FOP in Philadelphia did. So Rochelle, thanks for coming on the show.
So, Rochelle, before you got here, we were talking about, like, trying to understand exactly what the Guardian Civic League is as in its relationship to the Fraternal Order of Police. Can you clarify that for us? Is it fair to consider you as John McNesby's counterpart, or are you guys not like a union in that context?
We are a civic organization. Guardian Civic League was formed in 1956 for the purpose of seeing that people of color and African-American police officers were treated fairly. Because you can imagine in 1956 just what was going on in reference to African-Americans. They wasn't hiring us. We couldn't ride together. We couldn't go into white neighborhoods. And so therefore it was formed. They came together to protest how they were being treated. So that's what the Guardian Civic League was formed. So our preamble states, our job is to be the conscience of the justice system, to make sure people of color are treated fairly. It's also to build the bridge between the communities and the communities that look like us. And it also to speak out on disparity and racism as part of the institution. Now, I've been a part of a lot of organizations. National Black Police Association is one, which is I was the vice chair of. I'm also the Philadelphia representative for Black Cops Against Police Brutality. I mean, the Pennsylvania representative for Black Cops Against Police Brutality. So the mission is just broad. It's just to make sure that people are treated fairly. That's what we do.
So I want to get into some of, I guess, you know, what you've been outspoken about in the police department, but maybe actually we're going to start with why did you want to become a cop initially? I think that that's often, I've heard people describe the challenge today in terms of trying to recruit younger black and brown boys and girls to think about the police force. What brought you into it? Why did you want to do it?
First of all, I didn't like cops growing up.
Okay, that was kind of my question.
I'm a child from North Philly. And what I saw used to be called boot kickers is now highway patrol, what they used to do to people that looked like me in my neighborhood. I was a childie. I saw it. So I didn't like cops. There was a police officer who was African-American, who was part of the Guardian Civic League, that would come through our neighborhood. And as bad as we would treat him, he would keep constantly say to us, if you want to do something to change you, you need to be a part of it. That went in one ear and out the other. Now, to move forward, my best friends joined the police department before me, got on a job. And they kept trying to say to me that you need to do this job. You need to do this job. And I'm like, I don't want to be no cop. This, what do they do but other than come through our neighborhoods and abuse us? So at the time, I was working for the post office, and my mother thought that was the greatest job ever, working for the post office, and I just thought it was another plantation. If you ever worked for the post office, if you ever been inside where the workers were working when I worked there, to me that was a plantation. And the police department came with an offer. You can join the police department. I got my girlfriends encouraging me to be a part of it, to make the difference, or you can stay in the post office where you need to retire at 65. The police department came with, well, you can do 20 years and age 45 and you can retire. That was a no-brainer.
Pretty good, yeah.
I needed a job. I had friends already there. They were saying, come on, to make a change. I read up on the Guardian Civic League and I only saw what Alfonso Dill was doing. Then I made the decision to take the test and come on the police department.
So was it more about economics or was it more about altruism? Or was it 50-50?
It was 50-50. Okay. One, I wanted to get out of the plantation of the post office. And two, I needed the job in order to feed myself and pay my bills. And there's a third part because I had friends there that kept saying to me and hearing the Guardian Civic League officers that if you want to change what they do in your community, then you need to be a part of it. To be a part of that change.
So yes, you grew up, you know, witnessing police brutality and not having the best image of cops. You know, when you first then went to take the test and you first, you know, became a recruit, I would assume that would be the process you went through. Did it make more sense, or were you surprised about anything, you know, in terms of how those individuals who were police officers that you saw who maybe weren't good cops, like did it all kind of make sense when you were in there, or like were you surprised at what you found?
Let me tell you this. It's funny because I tell the children this when I go to schools to teach. When I got into the academy, now mind you, and you poor and you living in a neighborhood where everybody else is poor, you don't see true racism. You don't experience it right up in your face. When I got into the police academy, I experienced true straight up racism.
Like
racism.
Name calling.
The disparity on how white officers or recruits were treated versus
Absolutely.
Black officers. And that little thing was dealing with driver training. Driver training, we would, you know, get in cars and we were learning how to navigate through these little cones in reference to training you how to drive a police vehicle. I'm in line. There's a white girl in front of me who is a recruit also. And she looks in the car, and you know the people who just got their license. She looks in the car, and she says, I don't want to ride with them. And the white instructor says to her, okay, get the next one. Next one come, they're more experienced drivers, she gets in the car. Now it's my turn. I'm standing up there, car pulls up. You know the ones that just got their license. I say, I don't want to ride with them. Well, the white instructor says, you are being insubordinate, and I'm going up there and have you thrown out of the academy. Now, I see that what stopped that was the black supervisor, sergeant, by the name of Glisby. He came down to me. He said, Blau, what happened? I said, white girl, look in the car, says she don't want to ride. White instructor says, okay. Black girl, look in the car and says she don't want to ride. White instructor says, I'm insubordinate. He said, I knew that had happened. You ain't going nowhere. Go back to driving.
Is it fair to say that there's always been a culture of white supremacy in policing, even in today?
Well, we're dealing with that issue really today in reference to one of these officers is riding around with the framed Confederate flag on his vehicle.
This is a Philadelphia police officer.
Philadelphia police corporal.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And why is he allowed to do that?
And that's what we're discussing. So this you will see that.
This hasn't made the news yet, right?
It's about to.
Okay, so this, you're giving us a little bit of breaking news.
Breaking coming.
What district?
He works in a specialized unit. Yeah, that's what I say. But you could probably see it in reference to bigots with badges, because there's an organization called Bigots with Badges, and my boy is the chairperson of it. You could see it because it seems like they have an opinion of people of color. And it's not all of them. Some of them have it hidden well. Some of them just can't. They just want to be able to express themselves in reference to their bigot attitude. So you see it. And white supremacists, I call them all the same thing. They're all bigots. Mm. You can see it in the institution of law enforcement.
Just to clarify, though, you're... The corporal that you're referring to, that's his personal choice he wanted to do on his license plate. But right. you see that as emblematic of the larger culture.
That's correct.
You don't think that's an isolated incident?
No.
Okay.
Because if you know the history of that Confederate flag, and as a grown adult supervisor in this institution, you should know. I don't want to hear you don't know. And yet you think that's something that you can glorify or something that you can stand behind. Now, that's a problem, because now you're dealing with a lot of people of color, which that Confederate symbol is against. So, yeah, he has issues.
So, you know, one of the things people often talk about with the police department is, you know, a lot of, I should say, activism, people with social justice minded, you know, would like more officers to speak out. You've spoken out on a number of issues, you know, through the years. One of the fears people always talk about is that there's going to be retribution or, you know, backlash for doing it. And I know, or at least my understanding is, you've had a good, a fair amount of that over the years.
Oh, yeah. I've been threatened and all that. But see, when you're in policing, in order for people to do this, you need to know who you are as a person. I knew who I was as a person a long time ago. I had grandmothers and grandfathers that basically taught me the history of slavery and what I needed to stand up against. It's better than my soul, so I'm not scared of anyone. Second, I'm a spiritual person, so therefore, man doesn't scare me. That flood in Houston scares me. So when you see people in an institution, go back to your question, because I'm...
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was leading into, too, was, right, there was that investigation in 2013 that Ramsey did, right? And you said at the time that you felt like maybe it was politically motivated, I think. So Ramsey was looking into the... former Police Commissioner Ramsey, position that you had in Colwyn.
Oh, yeah.
And do you think that that was politically targeted because you had been an outspoken, you know, activist or reformer within the police department?
Oh, yes. It was like, I got you. I got you now. You done did something wrong. What they did not know, if you noticed, you saw nothing else about it. One is, when you are ready...
Can you just give a backstory for people who may not be familiar with it?
So, I was police officer in Philadelphia. I put in for my retirement, and I started consulting with Colwyn Borough in reference to their department. It's a smaller department. It had basically no rules or regulations. They had no community involvement, and a borough council person by the name of Tonette Prey asked me to consult with them, which I did. My retirement papers was in. So therefore, I was running time, and I went over to Cowan to be the public safety director, which they hired me for. They was trying to put out that I was double dipping.
Right, that you were now, still being paid by at Philadelphia while getting paid by
Coleman. When you are your retirement part and you put in your retirement papers and you want to run your time, every single person that has another job or goes to another job does the same thing. I have a list of people that's been years on the payroll working at another job.
But I hear about that all the time.
Yeah, so therefore they're coming at me because of my outspokenness. But yet nothing came about it. I even had two of my so-called corporals who I promoted when I got there to attempt to arrest me for doing my job in cowering. Yet that was thrown out by the DA's office. And then when they put, the FBI and all that, was phony. And it was to come at me to try to make me shut up, which I'll never do, especially when I know I'm right in doing what I do.
So, to the core of his question about black officers speaking out, I mean, as you heard in the monologue, there's in a lot of protests, activists want black officers to say something about what's happening. Why don't they do that? Because, I mean, is that something that's in their work rules that they can't speak while they're in uniform?
Well, that may be a part of their policy. You really don't get in political in reference to the charter of people working for the city. They are afraid in some instances to speak out of those issues involving the different things going on with the city, especially things that are happening to black males and black females in today's sense. Some of them are afraid.
But do they have the right to do it? Can a black police officer speak out about the David Jones shooting if he wanted to?
I just retired in 2013. I spoke out against instances in the police department way before 2013.
Okay.
So you can speak out. You may not can speak out when you're on the front line dealing at a protest. You may not can do that there. Mm-hmm. But if there's an issue of concern that you know is wrong, you can speak out against it. Some don't. Because you got to remember, this institute was formed by white supremacists.
Right.
This institution was formed to capture black people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So you're now in it. And those who've been entrenched in it, like a cancer all the way down to the bone, are everywhere. So when you speak out, you got to look the fact that you are going to be retaliated against. You are going to be targeted. And if they don't get you now, they got so many friends in this institution that 10 years later, they can still come at you. I have a member of my organization that's a detective. And when he has an African-American supervisor, he's fine. But as soon as there's a white supervisor, he's immediately targeted.
Just a quick follow-up. Do you have any insight into the whistleblower policy at the Philadelphia Police Department? I mean, Ross says that there's a strong whistleblower policy and that they protect the whistleblowers. I mean, is that true?
There is a whistleblower policy in the department. How do they protect officers? I don't know, because I see those are still retaliated. I'm dealing with two female officers in the 39th District who a white supervisor thought it was funny to belittle them in front of his friends. And no sooner than they make a complaint about it, now they retaliated that the position they was in, now they be trying to be thrown out of there. And we're dealing with their attorneys in reference to that. And every little thing that they do, they're retaliated against, or they're given a counseling memo. So, when you do, you got to be prepared to fight and take the backlash. And the reason why the Guardian stands today is because when I did, the community came out. When we shut down that Dome Likes Racist website, my life was threatened. The police department come with this superficial, we're going to ride behind you when you go to work. You know who came and stood in my neighborhood? The Nation of Islam, basically. Anybody come near your house, they were dealt with. So, and I got all kinds
of the Nation of Islam,
and I got all kinds of systems up around my house. So if you can come if you want to, you're going to really have fun. And don't forget, I'm trained just like you are. I tell people, I'm not scared of these people. I would never be. Because don't forget, I was trained just like they are. I can articulate how I dealt with you when you came up on my steps.
The two officers you were just referring to who filed the complaint, just to be clear, do cops, when they file complaints, go through a separate system than civilians, or do they also file with, like, the Police Advisory Commission, or is there a separate apparatus for police officers?
Well,
Internal Affairs?
They file the EEO.
What's that?
Well, it's the EEO complaint, Equal Opportunity complaint. They file it with the state and the federal government, and they file it with the department. I always say to my cops, don't even go to the department. Because basically, when you file a complaint within the city and you're a police officer, people get notified because of who they know. There are different people everywhere. And so they get notified, and then this is what I say. Now, whether they actually do this, I think they go down the shore and they meet up and they come up with a strategy to come back at you. And so therefore, then they begin to test the lie. But I tell you this, what they can't do is backtrack their lies, because they always mess up in that instance. That's why the city pays out lots of money in reference to lawsuits dealing with that, because they try to backtrack in reference to their story or their lie in reference to the officer. No, so they filed it, and they have an attorney, and they're dealing with it, and we'll be coming out with that too.
So we actually started off air talking about this upcoming movie, or I guess it's out in select theaters, Crown Heights.
September 15th.
There we go. Very nice. And it's about, you know, a man who's wrongfully convicted of murder. And Rochelle, you made an interesting comment just talking about also, I guess, the flip side in some cases. Maybe you could just clarify and elaborate a little bit of recently seeing, I guess, wrongful accusations at police officers as well, that it can go both ways. Tell me a little bit about what you were referring to.
In this institution, because I don't label everybody bad except certain groups. They just inherently bad. You have police officers, just like the whistleblower situation, that stand up and speak out and complain about differences, and they're targeted. They're retaliated against in this institution.
Within, so other police officers or supervisors, you know, retaliating against officers.
They do.
You know, say slapping them with things like, you know, I don't know, messing up a crime. That's probably not a good example. But
disciplinary action. Because everything is by disciplinary action. They become conduct unbecoming, which is abstract. You could do anything and be conduct unbecoming. The way that sounds is like, that's egregious. But you could talk back at a supervisor and that's conduct unbecoming. So they start building up the disciplinary action in their record, in their files. And so now they go to take a test, become a supervisor, and now they got that to contend with. See, they try to dirty up their file. Just like if you a citizen out there, they try to arrest you on petty things to pile up on you. So they do the same thing in this institution. It's no different. I try to tell cops, you have the same amount of numbers that when they arrest a person, they have the same amount. PPN number is the same amount of numbers as a police officer's payroll number.
That's really interesting. I mean, I think it's like, you know, any cop, say, who even wants to do good, then they get technically labeled, I guess, as a bad cop, and, you know, in terms of disciplinary action because of that.
Because they listen to other folks and not basically judge people on their own character. The rumor mill about a cop in the department is atrocious. They can put out a word that this person is this way, and it can be totally false. But because they all go by this rumor mill, because a lot of cops live in this bubble, and I got to explain the bubble because that's really deep to me. The bubble is this. If you a police officer and you come on this job and you no longer hang out with your regular friends, now police become everything that you do. You hang out with them, you go to bar with them, you party with them, you go on vacation with them, you work with them. You're now in this bubble. So your reality is limited because you no longer are the person that you were before. And so you can see how they all slip up into this I'm blue thing. I tell people, I ain't never been blue. I've always been black. I work with people who wear blue uniforms. So I don't know where you get this I'm blue thing from, because you're not.
So that's kind of what I was referring to in the beginning, where I talked about people who have good intentions and then get corrupted, right? I mean, so does it really take a strong person to not be corrupted, or is it almost everybody that walks into that system somehow or another will be cannibalized by the culture?
I say you have to know who you are as a person. Police is what you do.
Mm-hmm.
It's not who you are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so when you let who you are become that culture of just policing, then you are corrupt. You're easily corrupt. And then if you don't know who you are as a person, that you can do something more or better if you leave this job, if all you think you can do is just policing, then you're going to be easily corrupt into mm-hmm. that blue mentality.
So how do you feel when you hear that the slogan Blue Lives Matter? I mean, what does that mean to you? How do you connect with that, if at all?
I don't, because okay. I'm not blue. I'm black. Mm-hmm. So when you start coloring people, I'm black. So, you know, and they not blue. That's blue uniform. They use that as an acronym, I guess, for policing. I never been. All lives matter to me. And right now, because of the atrocities that are happening to people of color, black lives matter to me also. And so, you know, I've never been blue. Yeah. I don't even go do that.
Quick follow-up, too. You said earlier that you don't try to label everybody a bad cop except for a certain few. How do you define a bad cop, and how do you define a good cop? Because I think there's so many definitions where people say, oh, these are one of the good cops, but what does that mean to you when you call someone a good cop? What are those characteristics? And when you call someone a bad cop, what are those characteristics?
The good cop is the person that is conscious in reference to who you are as a person. And you do have to arrest people out there, because there are bad people out there. It's how you treat them when you do. You don't try to belittle them. You don't try to beat them up. You don't try to unnecessarily charge them with stuff that's not even there. You don't try to plant things on them. You don't try to justify actions that you didn't do. A bad cop is, he lives off of arrest. He or she lives off of overtime. He or she are very disrespectful to people. He or she basically belittle people who may have been arrested before, but, you know, they constantly try to belittle anybody out there, whether they poor, whether they're Hispanic, whether they're African-American. A bad cop lies. That's a bad cop. Good cop, it treats people with respect and dignity, no matter what it is that they have to do, literally. And if they have to arrest somebody, they don't make more out of it than it is. And it's not a part of them. This person said you did this, you had this in your pocket, I got to take it to the detective visit, they'll make the decision. And they walk away. They don't sit there and try to make something up to make it fit. I'm almost like, David. Fit, you must have quit. So they don't try to make things fit. They don't try to add things into a situation to try to make an arrest. There's a lot of people out you can arrest people for. They don't make up stuff. They don't lie into the process. You know what I mean? That's a good cop. That's a bad cop. Excuse me. Correct that. Mm. That's a bad cop.
Yeah, right.
Good cops are out there sincerely to help folks. They're out there to do their job. They're not out there to come out there to hurt people. When you see them pull up to a situation, they are pleasant initially. They're not aggressive. They don't come out with an attitude. Now, some good cops may have an attitude one day because they're human beings. But that's not what they do all the time. And so the ones that are bad.
Is Richard Ross a good cop or a bad cop?
Richard Ross is a police commissioner.
Fair enough.
So, first of all, I probably should have said this at the start of the show. At the time of this taping, we're extremely grateful for Rochelle to come in because her basement is currently flooded, and so we won't keep her for too long. With that out of the way, you know, you've seen a lot of police commissioners, and just to kind of bring it into the present, you know, from Sylvester Johnson to Ramsey, and you know, I can go back further. Where, you know, from the perspective of someone who's been within that system, where are we at now with reforms? I mean, do we not give enough credit for the police department that they've come this far, or should we, I mean, be, you know, expectedly pushing them as aggressively, you know, in terms of activism, pushing them as aggressively as we should? Like, do we not give them enough credit for reforms that they've made? How do you feel about that?
You can give them credit for reforms that they made, but you never let up on pushing them to make more. Because there's always, this is 2017, there's always an update. You know, you just like computer systems, they always update. So you need to make sure that they are updated. You need to make sure that they are dealing with the current issues in reference to what's going on with the community, and especially in police and community relationships. You have to keep pushing them. Though I commend for some of the stuff, but I'm still trying to figure out a witness protection program for police officers that come forward. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask the DA that, and I'm pushing for the commissioner. What do you do? Because they are still targeting these people that come forward and stand up and speak out. So what do you do?
What would that look like?
Ideally,
in your head, what would that look like?
In my head, you move them out of where they were.
Into another district.
Another district or another unit. Mm-hmm. And you monitor them for that 5 or 10 year period. So if a reoccurrence comes up, that's like an injury that they had. You could be injured and you go back to work and you're fine. And all of a sudden, the injury that you had in your back, and now your back is starting to hurt 10 years down the line. So that now you have a reoccurrence because you want them to go look and see if the work they did on your back was correct or is it eroding. So the reoccurrence part is where I talked about earlier, is where you can be good after, you know, filing a lawsuit against the city and coming up with certain things, like I said about my detective in one of the detective division. And he's fine if there's an African-American captain there. But as soon as there's some other captain that comes there, then he's immediately targeted. And this is 10, 15 years down the line. So there need to be a protection that if people start trying to target the person that spoke up anywhere in his career, anywhere in her career, then that need to be immediately dealt with.
I'm curious, as Malcolm was talking about the police commissioners, and, you know, we can't have this conversation without talking about Frank Rizzo, right? I mean, you grew up in Philadelphia, you mm-hmm. were a police officer, and I'm sure you lived through the Rizzo era, and now you're present in this conversation about what to do with the statue. I mean, what do you make of Rizzo's legacy? And you know, Frank Rizzo was a former police commissioner turned mayor. Some people consider him a brute. Some people consider him a hero. He's a high school dropout who ascended to the highest office in the city, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, that is something worthy of marvel, but there's a complicated legacy. And I'm just wondering, you know, as a black police officer, how do you identify with Frank Rizzo's legacy? And what should be done with the statue that's down in Center City?
I wasn't on the force when Frank Rizzo was
right.
rampant. Mayor Good was the mayor when I graduated. Mm-hmm. But I lived in the neighborhoods where those who was under Frank Rizzo, where they terrorized, especially neighborhoods of color. And so he had to have known that this was going on. And to me, he sanctioned it mm-hmm. because they will come through our neighborhoods like Castafo people, mm-hmm. which you read about in under Putin regime.
So it was a legit occupying army.
Occupied wasn't the word for how they used to come through our neighborhood. If you lived in North Philly, you see some people be, oh, I lived up in Mount Airy. Well, Mount Airy to us was the uppity people when I was coming up. And so was Winfield when I was coming up. And so, but living in North Philly and West Philly and some parts of South Philly, those areas were occupied by police because they felt as though that everybody that lived down there was bad. And so Rizzo don't get a good mark from me, because I'm a child of the terror that happened. For as police is concerned, to my understanding from police that I talked to, he was in favor of police people. So if you would make a mistake, he wouldn't hurt your family by not taking money away from you, but he would discipline you. He would put you on a bridge and you would walk it in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. So he would deal with you as a cop, but he wouldn't hurt the family. A police family, so therefore he was a cop's person. You have some that says he was a good person because of what he did for them individually, and that's how they deal with it. But I look at the totality of the Rizzo era, and as a child growing up, he was not good for us.
Is there any truth to the fact that Rizzo kind of desegregated the police department? He got more African-Americans on the force. Is there any truth to that?
Well, that I don't know, because to my understanding, they had to sue the city in order to get people of color on that force.
Yeah, I think it happened. I mean, my understanding, I think it happened under his watch, but I don't think he wanted it.
Okay, he wasn't a cheerleader for it.
He couldn't have been a cheerleader for it, because we had this, they had to sue the department. The Guardian Civic League sued the city of Philadelphia in reference to African Americans.
What year was this?
Ooh, I think there was a consent decree up to 2000.
This began in the 70s?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the consent decree.
Because I remember the DOJ sued Rizzo for police brutality, but I wasn't aware that there was a lawsuit about hiring, too.
Oh, yes, because they had the consent decree came to this point where that's how I got on the force. That the amount of people that took the test, that's the amount of people that had to go into the police academy. Mm-hmm. And so the Guardian Civic went out on all over the city to recruit us to join the police department. I'm telling you, this cop that came to my neighborhood, that's all he used to talk about. So they had to join the force. He had to get us to join the force, mm-hmm. under that consent decree. And the percentage of people that took that test, that's the percentage that had to be in the classes. When I came through the academy, if 67% took that test, 67% okay. had to be in those classes. And so when I came through the classes, there was a lot of people that looked like me. Mm-hmm. Not today.
Mm-hmm. So just to follow up, what should they do with the statue? Should it go in the museum? Should they put it in South Philly? Where do you think it's appropriate place for that statue?
I think it should be in a museum, mm-hmm. because some people have good history in reference to Rizzo, and some people have bad history. And so, therefore, all the things that deal with the good and the bad perception of things need to be in museums. They don't need to be out basically saying to people, I'm reaming over you. I'm reaming over you. I'm dealing with you. And a lot of feelings of hurt and injuries and death came from underneath you as the individual. So I think it should be in a museum. Mm.
So we're going to wrap up in a minute, but I was curious, as head of the Guardian Civic League, the Guardian Civic League endorsed Larry Krasner for district attorney. The FOP obviously has endorsed Beth Grossman, correct? I was just wondering, like, you know, you've had this whole career in decades in terms of speaking out against things. I was wondering if you got any pushback when you did endorse Larry Krasner, or if that's basically like kind of par for the course with you, and you know, it's not even worth complaining because people know where you're coming from.
Well, see, you have to explain to people because they get misinformation. Some of our members, oh, he's gonna come at the cops. No, he's not. He cannot come at the cops if cops don't do anything. That's the first thing. Second, when they were like, well, he's a civil rights attorney, I said, well, you got to understand, most of y'all are born out of civil rights. Mm-hmm. Our organization came out of civil rights. The civil rights era allowed us to be who we are. So I'm like, to me, it ain't a bad thing to have a person who dealt with people's civil rights in their DA's office, because I'm thinking it's going to be more of a balance, hopefully. It's going to be more fair in reference to. He's not going to come at the cops. If you do your job and you have the evidence, those DAs are going to still lock you up. Right. There's no change. But if you are a rude cop out there just going crazy,
racking up arrests for no reason.
And the evidence is there, then you are going to be arrested. Where you come out that way, I don't understand. In reference to Larry, we went for Rich Negrin originally because we liked what he said. And though we interviewed Larry Krasner, Rich Negrin, Tariq Shabazz, the membership chose Rich. Rich did not win. And so now you have the election. We are not, our organization has never been a follower of anybody. Though our members are members of the FOP, and so am I. And so I don't follow people to where they go. We go with the conscience of the membership, and the conscience of the membership chose Larry Krasner, and that's what we're going to do.
One thing Larry Krasner has been outspoken about is police transparency. He believes that officers, I mean, he believes in the body cameras, but he also believes that officers' names should be released in the case of a shooting. The FOP now is fighting that in a very high-profile way after there was a protest at the home of the officer who killed David Jones. And now they filed this suit against the city. I mean, is that something that the Guardian Civic League is going to take a position on whether the officer's name should be released? I mean, how do your members feel about that proposition?
I think you would have most police officers may not wanting that. I think there need to be an avenue in which that they need to be released. And there's an avenue in circumstances that they can't. If there's a situation where all of a sudden the person's life is being threatened, a police officer's
life
is being
threatened. But that's almost never happens, right?
Well, you're right. It almost never happens. But I think Asa Khalif out at the police officer's house just gave them a up mm-hmm. on not releasing the police officer's name, because now I don't have a problem with people protesting. But when you hold a city, a block hostage because of the action of
that's,
one
that's
person.
That's strong terms to call it, to say it was hostage.
Because you did.
No, I was there. That's not fair to say they were held hostage.
But what you did, you disrupted everybody else's life on that block that had nothing to do with what that cop did.
But isn't that the same if somebody held a protest in Center City and they held up traffic? The people in traffic
you
didn't
have
anything to do with that.
You can hold up traffic. You can do it in Center City.
So cops' homes should be off limits?
I think you shouldn't go to their house because they got family. They got children. Their children don't have anything to do with what that cop did. And if you don't want my child traumatized by police coming into their neighborhood and into their house, then you shouldn't expect their children, they're human beings, they have families, to be traumatized by those actions either. I don't have a problem with the names coming out, just to ensure that they are not targeted or any threats come against them, to ensure that whatever situation went down doesn't put their whole family in jeopardy.
So does the Guardian Civic League plan to testify on behalf of the city that these names should continue to come out? Or, I mean, what, or do you guys plan to stay neutral?
We're going to stay neutral on that one. Okay. Because there's two aspects that we're looking at that.
Okay. We'll have to leave it there. Rochelle, thank you so much for coming on. It was really just really insightful, and it was just a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So that was quite the conversation with Rochelle Bilal, who's the president of the Guardian Civic League. I think I agree with almost everything she said until it got to the end.
You were just chomping at the bit until we got there.
Yeah, well, because, you know, I disagree. Well, first of all, I didn't agree with the language, and that's the language that the media has been using about the protests at the officer's home, that they held the neighbors hostage. And, you know, if anything, it was the police holding the protesters hostage. I mean, there were 30 police officers, helicopters, neighbors around. It was the police who blocked the street. And I just don't think that the police are above anybody else. And if we can protest the mayor in his space where he's feel comfortable at City Hall, you can protest the district attorney where they feel comfortable, you should be able to take it to the officer's house. Philadelphia didn't do anything unique. This has been done in other cities where they've gone to the house of officers. So other than that, I think it was a great conversation. I think that she gave a lot of insight into, you know, what a good cop is, what a bad cop is, and some of the policies and stuff. What did you make of the interview?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the big things that I took away from it was I knew she grew up in North Philly, but I didn't know, like, how she felt about the police department. I didn't know mm-hmm. if, like, she was in a family of cops or something. I thought that was interesting, and also just to, I don't know, even for my own good, not to jump to conclusions, or if you see a black cop, you know, to assume how they feel about the police department, to mm-hmm. You know, assume that either they're falling in line or complicit with something, you know. I think that's interesting. Like, from the start, her perspective was that even when she was going into the police department, that she didn't necessarily like the police. So right. I thought that was an interesting perspective.
And I think she's maintained her conviction even till today that there is a culture of white supremacy that exists in the police department. And she didn't try and dance around it like other people do. There's implicit bias and there's some prejudice. No, it's like, no, it's white supremacists. It's a culture of white supremacy, and it's racist as fuck. Yeah. And, you know, you have to have unions or organizations like the Guardian Civic League who will talk like that, because the FOP will never acknowledge white supremacy in the police department. The police commissioner will never acknowledge white supremacy in the police department. Neither will the mayor.
Yeah.
So I think if you don't have that type of association and you don't have those black activists who call it out and speak truth to power, you never hear it.
Yeah. So this
also the other thing real quick.
Yeah, yeah, go.
I found it really interesting that she didn't identify with the Blue Lives Matter.
Yeah, no, she would pretty much
condemn
it. And I was going to point out, but I was going to give her a break because her basement's flooded. She was wearing a blue shirt when she was saying, like, you know, I don't wear blue. Or she said something.
She said, I'm not blue.
I'm not blue, but then, or something about, yeah.
I've never heard a police officer reject the Blue Lives Matter thing.
Completely, yeah. Right? I mean, it wasn't like, you know, it's complicated or something. Like, it was like, no, that's not me. I thought that was actually very strong. Yeah. Or stronger than I
expected. Very strong, yeah.
So this being the season finale, it's been quite a journey from our humble beginnings as Pushback back in January, I believe.
Yeah, Martin Luther King Day, and first that, kind of pilot.
Yes, and we're recording this at the end of August, so it's been, 2017 has been a crazy year to begin with, right? Yeah. There's been a lot to cover.
Shout out to all of the listeners out there who have been. I mean, there's some people who've come up on the street to me who have listened to all of them. I'll give them a quick shout out now if I can. Kevin Harding Jr., attorney of the city, said Black Intellectuals. The Black Intellectuals really? Episode was his favorite one. Waqar, what's his name? Waqar Vick, who is a Villanova law student hoping to become a public defender. He listens to every episode. So there's people that I come up on the street, and they're just like, man, I really love this Pushback. Sherry Honkala sent me a message saying that this has become her favorite show. Hmm. This is something that needs to continue. So I think, you know, we've only done, 9 episodes in this season?
Something like that,
or 10 episodes. Something so like that, I think it's continually needed to build an audience. But the people who have been listening and who are appreciative of it are influencers in this city, people who are legitimately rooted in the social justice space. I think that's a good look.
Yeah, and I was at the Word Founders Day event in late August, and just a number of members of kind of the Word listenership, Word community came up to me. Or they asked me what my name was. I introduced them. Oh, yeah, Pushback. And that's cool to hear. It's good to hear. Sometimes you put things out in the world and don't know who's consuming them, if anyone. So call your senator, call your congressman, and make sure that Pushback stays on the air for 2018. You know, call Pat Toomey. You know, make sure that.
Did you have a favorite episode of Pushback?
I was going to ask you that question. Let's see here. Man, I don't want to. I feel like I'd be.
Dissing everybody else?
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the most like neutral or political answer that I could have. But to be honest,
I would say this. I enjoyed every episode we did of Pushback.
Naturally.
But I would say the most revealing would have to be Larry Krasner's. And then maybe this one with Rochelle. I really enjoyed the conversation.
I really enjoyed this conversation too with Rochelle. I mean, maybe it's just my short-term memory, but I was actually going to say this one.
Yeah?
Probably just because it literally just happened.
Yeah. But just in terms of what you learned from the person, you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And also when we had Anthony Hirschbiel on for the Politics of Pot.
That story was really powerful. That was a really powerful story.
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of big ideas, big plans for potentially season 2 with Pushback. If you want to send us your ideas or just get in touch with us to talk about what you liked, what you didn't, please reach out to us on social media. You
can Flood the Drummer on Twitter.
And at Malcolm Burnley.
And of course, you can just go back to phillymag.com/podcast. If you've missed any episodes, they're all right there. And they're also on iTunes. You can subscribe on iTunes. So if you're just listening to this episode and just discovered Pushback, there is a host of content for you to consume. It's still very timely. It's still very relevant. Still very shareable. And so we encourage you to do that. And
real quick, I like that solidarity episode we did. I know that there was some mixed feelings about that, but I think that was our
that
second
was a good
episode. It was an interesting idea.
That was with the mayor,
idea.
Right?
Yeah. So anyways.
Think about it. We've had the mayor of Philadelphia. We've had the Democratic nominee for district attorney. Mm-hmm. We've had the president of the Black Police Union, mm-hmm. a Black Police Association. We've had a political candidate, vice presidential candidate. I mean, that's pretty.
We had Keir Bradford Gray.
Keir Bradford Gray is the public defender. Asa Clay. I mean, this is hitters. Chris Goldstein, Lynn Washington. I mean, when you look at it in totality, we had some pretty big names. It gives us a pat on the back. This was pretty impressive. And I think we did take up a space in this city that mm-hmm. was missing.
Mm-hmm.
And we gave these activists and these freedom fighters a voice. I think that it's needed.
And it couldn't be at a better time, right? I mean,
yeah.
And so hopefully we'll continue this as the Trump presidency gets more and more perilous and as there's more and more topics of race and policing that we have to deal with in Philadelphia and also just nationally. We hope to be coming back to you and bringing you the conversations you want to hear.
So shout out to Word Radio and Philly Magazine. You can also follow them on Twitter @PhillyMag and @OnWord. And so for Malcolm Burnley, I'm Flood the Drummer. Until next time, I'm Drumming for Justice.
Peace.